everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Geek Warning Podcast, brought to you by the Escape Collective, your one-stop shop for everything you need to know this week in the world of bicycle tech. On today's show, we're going to talk to you about tech highlights from the Sea Otter Classic trade show that I just got back from a few days ago. We're going to chat about helmet straps and the proper way to apply chain lube. There is a proper way, apparently. We're also going to try and figure out what the heck is going on. Okay. And we're also going to try and figure out what the heck is going on at Kona and Stages. And we're going to talk about tracking down mystery creeks and our favorite floor pumps. I'm James Huang. And joining me today is Escape Collective Senior Tech Editor Dave Rome. Hi, Dave.
Hello.
I know this is starting to sound like a little bit of a broken record, but Ronan is out today, mainly because of how all of our time zones are arranged around this time of year. It's currently about 6 p.m. where I am right now. It's about 10 a.m. for Dave, which is 2 a.m. for Ronan. Ronan's a bit of a night owl, but maybe not quite that much of a night owl. So,
and I'm willing to do podcasts as early as 7 a.m., but the times I've done 6 a.m., I've been told by listeners that I sounded a little flat. So I try to avoid going before 7 a.m. now.
Yeah, Dave has made it very clear to me that he is not a morning person.
Yeah.
Well, Dave, just you and me again. I'm curious, what you got coming up on Threaded this week?
As suggested previously, decided to do internal cable routing. So yeah, tools, tricks, tools, tips, and tools.
Is it a one word column where it just says no?
It would certainly have been a lot quicker to have done that than what I actually did. But yeah, there's, I guess a summary of all the internal routing tools that I use, including ones that you wouldn't expect because they don't come from cycling brands. One of which actually comes from a discount craft shop. So,
intriguing.
Which may or may not be able to be replicated now that I think about it. But anyway, I'll share my that's one of my best kept secrets, dare I say, that this this thing I will be sharing in the article. I kind of felt like one day I might just buy a bag of 1,000 of these and sell them for $10 a piece and become a millionaire. But I'm going to give away the secret.
Dave, is there any mention of swearing?
Of course. Yeah, I don't think you can really cover internal cable routing without it. So, yes, of course there is. But hopefully, this article leads to less of that.
Okay, well, I am looking forward. Yeah. Well, I was going to say that I'm looking forward to it, but maybe I don't need to be reminded how much I did. Anyway. We're not going to beat that.
Yeah, I can see you getting angry now.
let's talk about Sea Otter. Let's talk about
your time in Monterey?
A much happier topic. Aside from the fact that I'm still dealing with apparently the tail end of some bronchitis, it was a good show. The weather was awesome. I actually really enjoy Sea Otter. I think this is close to the 20th Sea Otter I've attended now. And it has been pretty interesting to watch it evolve because it used to be that the expo part was almost kind of like more of a sideshow to go along with all the racing that was going on there. And then it became more of a mountain bike trade show. And with Interbike going away a few years ago, it really has now become like the premier launch event for the North American market for basically everything, mountain, road, everything in between.
Sorry, you said your 20th?
I think it's close to my 20th. Yeah.
Do they give you like a belt buckle or something for that?
No. They do give you free snacks in the media room, though.
Yeah, but rookies get that as well. So
That's true. But
I feel like... Yeah. Yeah, right. I feel like you should have your own section of the media room. Maybe one situated in the middle of the expo rather than outside.
No special table.
A golf cart that you get to drive around.
No golf cart. No padded chair. Nope. Nothing like that. Nope.
Wow. Huh. All right. So, what did you see?
I mean, there was actually a bunch of cool stuff. I'm not going to run through all of it because there's a whole bunch of galleries that are up on the site right now. So, if you want to, you can head over to escapecollective.com and take a look at everything. But
sorry, I guess before we get started, I think it's probably worth painting a picture of how big Sea Otter is. So, you say it's roughly 1,000 exhibitors these days.
It is about 1,000 exhibitors, and I'm sure Sea Otter is including like food vendors and stuff like that, but there aren't that many food vendors.
Yeah. And so, it sits within the Laguna Seca, famous Laguna Seca race course.
Correct.
And it so fills it's most of the central pit.
It's an outdoor event. It basically fills up Yeah, most of the, I guess what you'd call the infield, I guess, of the racetrack. I don't know what it is in terms of floor area. But yeah, it is an outdoor event, so it is subject to weather, and I have certainly seen a fair bit of weather at Sea Otter. Yeah, this one was good in that sense. So,
and 1,000 exhibitors, how long do you think it would take to walk from one end to the other, keeping in mind that it's kind of almost a perfect circle of exhibitors?
You know, it's hard to say because it's definitely a pretty circuitous layout. It's not like it's arranged into neat aisles and rows and that sort of thing. Because you've got like...
lakes in the middle and stuff.
You've got like three pods sort of in the middle, and then like they're surrounded by this back row, and now there's this like further back area that's on the pavement part, and then there's this other row on the other side of the... It's a bit of a jumble, so you kind of... I definitely feel for anyone who has never been to Sea Otter before, trying to figure out where everything is and how everything's arranged. Because again, I've been there for a whole bunch of times and I still get kind of turned around a little bit.
Yeah.
But it's gotten pretty big. And I know I told you this on Slack the other day, but you know, I was the only one from Escape Collective there covering everything. And I thought I allowed myself enough time. I gave myself basically 3 full days and like a 4th morning, and it wasn't enough. I could have used another day and a half probably, or at least maybe I could have been much more abrupt in chatting with people.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So,
all right. So anyway, with that all mentioned, let's talk about some of the highlights that you saw.
So
you had.
Yeah, a bunch of cool stuff. So there's been a lot of talk about sustainability in the automotive world, particularly with tires and just kind of how you get little bits of rubber pollution everywhere. And just in general, talking about the resources that are required to make tires, and that is definitely making its way into the bicycle world. We've seen a few companies launching initiatives to use more sustainable recycled materials, that sort of thing. And Vittoria is very much on that bandwagon. And they showed off a new gravel tire called the Terreno Pro. And they're saying that this is a, what did they say? Like a 92% sustainable tire. That's how they're labeling it. But you know, you've got a tread made of natural rubber, ash silica that's derived from rice husks and soybean oil. And then you've got a casing that's made of recycled nylon that they get from fishing nets and organic cotton. And there's not a whole lot else in there. So the tread's kind of like this unusual brown color, almost like an old Tioga Psycho, if you can remember way back when. And Vittoria is saying that the tread rubber is nearly as good in terms of rolling resistance and durability and all the other stuff as compared to one of their more conventional rubbers that has more like carbon black and graphene and stuff in it. And they are saying, in addition with the new casing that they have, supposedly it's actually a higher performing gravel tire than anything else that they've had before. I don't have anything on cost. I also don't have any notes right now on pricing or on weight either, but it's apparently going to launch sometime around like May-ish or so. My understanding is it's not going to be quite a bit more expensive than a conventional tire, if at all. And what I'm kind of wondering is if this actually does take off, if the performance really is as good or at least close to a kind of like quote unquote normal tire. I wonder how long it'll be before like we start seeing brown tread as kind of more of a, almost kind of like a regular normal color as opposed to the typical black.
I certainly think in the gravel space, it'll be trendy to have.
It's a really good looking tire, I think. It's like, you know, tanned wall with that sort of brown tread. Like it's a really neat eye-catching color. Yeah. And then, you know, Vittoria also introduced a new tread pattern. They're going to have a new way of naming their tread instead of having it be like Terreno Dry and mixed and all the other stuff. They're going to call it, they're going to switch to this T numerical setup. So it's like T50, sort of just like middle of the road. And then like T60, sort of going to be like a little bit burlier terrain. And they're just going to kind of go in this sort of linear numerical setup.
Is that for the tread pattern or the tread compound?
That's for the tread pattern.
All right.
And that's how they're going to do it for gravel moving forward. I wonder if they're going to do that for the mountain bike too, though. Although at that point, you're going to have like a little bit more variation in terms of like mud and stuff like that. But anyway, certainly at least for gravel, I think it'll be easier for people to understand what's what.
Okay.
So that was neat.
So like a T100 would be the most aggressive tread imaginable.
Correct. That would be
a tread. And
it'd be a mountain bike tire.
And a T0 would be a road slick.
Essentially that's kind of how I discussed it with them too.
Right.
And then it would, for people who do mixed tires, like a different one on the front and the back. It would also kind of help people pair tires together a little bit more obviously, like instead of going with something that would be like a T20 and a T80 or something, you would be maybe looking at something that's like a T30 and a T50. They're kind of two numbers that are a little bit closer together. Mm. But the idea is to make it a little bit easier for people to understand what tire to pick for given conditions. So
I can think of a lot of tire brands that could use a similar system.
I agree. Yeah. I was actually just chatting with a buddy of mine the other day. He was looking at some mountain bike tires and he was looking at some specialized ones in particular because they're all on sale. And he was trying to figure out like Eliminator versus Purgatory versus Butcher and all this other stuff. I'm like, they're kind of neat names, but it's not really obvious what's what.
Yep. So yeah, especially like in the Maxxis range. I'm more than a decade in, but I still keep deferring my PhD in Maxxis's tire range. So I'm not quite there yet. So very much an undergrad.
Yeah. Lots and lots of names. Other stuff I saw as far as whole bikes, I'd say the one that really sticks out in my head is that new Montebello from Ritchie. Technologically speaking, it's not anything groundbreaking. It's a TIG welded steel bike, you know, butted tubes, looks pretty nice. Very much classic proportions and silhouette and tubing sizes, that sort of thing, but it's just beautiful. It's this kind of Audax style bike. It's got clearance for 36 mil tires with fenders or 40 mils without, totally external cable routing actually with like split stops and everything, has a totally classic fastback seat cluster, front and rear fender mounts, dynamo routing up front. I don't have any info on pricing right now. Actually, I might have pricing on the website. I definitely don't have anything for weight. But the way they had it built, especially
pricing
at the show,
with Ritchie is not a lot. Weight is typically a lot.
either way, it was beautiful. And they had it built up with all polished silver components, and the paint was like this sort of like metallic red wine color thing. And it was just stunning. Like everyone who looked at it was just like, holy cow, that thing's beautiful.
How did they have it built? What sort of tie width did they have fitted to it?
I think they had it built up with like 35s or 36s or something. And they did have it with fenders, polished silver, of course.
Yeah.
It was all polished silver aluminum components. It had Ritchie's own polished aluminum wheel set. I don't remember what kind of group set they had on there, but it was just a very, very pretty bike. It's certainly not going to win, again, like any weight wars, or it's not going to be aero or anything like that, but that's not what it's for.
But as an all-day, go-anywhere road bike, it sounds quite nice. Yeah,
exactly. Sort of just like hop on and go and not really worry about when you're going to get somewhere. So nice. Fergus Tanaka from Ritchie, he actually used it in Paris-Brest Paris last year. So that gives you an idea of what it's for. I think it's coming up pretty soon. It's not on the Ritchie website yet, but pretty sure they're going to sell a fair number of those.
In a sea of new $5,000 carbon frame set releases, it's nice to see something so classic also coming out.
Yeah, because I think it's like sub 2K.
Yeah.
So pretty cool. Speaking of bikes, another one that's a little bit off the radar, it's from a little company called Digit. It's the Ring 290 trail bike. And this one comes from, it's a brand name that most people will have not heard of, but it comes from someone who a lot of people probably has had some experience with. The designer is Tim Lane. He worked at Felt for quite a long time. He's had his fingers in a lot of pies. It's an aluminum full suspension trail bike, 128 mil rear, 140 front, 290 front and rear. But it uses this, what they call it's analog suspension design. So there's a short link down by the bottom bracket. And then, up front, the top of the rear triangle drives directly a rear shock that is embedded. It's how it's completely inside of the top tube. And Digit is saying that it's actually sort of behaves like a more conventional short dual link bike. And the way that the upper part of the triangle moves, it basically behaves as if the upper link was an infinite length. It's actually pretty light. The whole bike is building up at about, sub 12 and a half kilos, which is about less than 27 pounds, which is pretty good for a pretty decent travel aluminum trail bike. Supposedly pedals quite well. I think it looks really clean. There's plenty of room for two water bottles, which is actually quite unusual for a bike with that kind of travel. Tim is building them himself, I think. They come with Cerakote ceramic coating, like painted to match fork, and pretty decent build kit. I'm actually really interested to ride that one because the original one that he came out with was a mullet bike. I'm personally not super big on the mullet thing for just sort of general trail riding, but now this is sort of a more of a bread and butter kind of build. So pretty sure Tim's going to sell more of these, I hope.
Yeah, nice. Okay.
So that was pretty
certainly
cool.
It certainly is a different looking bike. Like aesthetically, I'd say the closest thing on the market would be like the Trek Super Caliber in terms of
kind
how
of.
The rear shock hides. But yeah, I mean, how it works is obviously quite different. So they've been doing some cool stuff.
The
for
rear
a while
shock
now.
Is very much built into the top tube. Like it's not a conventional shock that's hidden inside. It's a proprietary rear shock, but it's massive and it's got, you know, super long stroke. So leverage ratio is super low, stuff like that. I'm very curious to ride one.
Yeah, nice.
Another thing that caught my eye kind of more on the tool front. So Stan's No Tubes, they had, it seems like pretty much everyone has high flow, no clog tubeless valves now. Cause I mean, standard Presta valves kind of suck for sealant, actually. So they have these new high flow valve stems called ExoCore. They look like they work really well. I've got some samples in my hands here, actually. What I was actually really excited about, though, from them, sorry, Mike, it stands. But what I was actually really excited about, even more so than those valve stems, were its new sealant injector. So they've always had this, you know, sort of just plastic syringe thing, sealant injector. And now they came out with an actual really different thing. They cut their own molds for the syringe and everything. So it's still a plastic syringe, still rubber tube. It's got a press on head, nothing crazy there. But in the head, there's now a one-way valve. So the idea is you can just pull out the plunger and then just fill up the syringe from the top. And because there is a little little channel molded into the syringe, you can then load the plunger without pressurizing the system yet. It's actually, for people who are familiar with suspension, it's almost kind of like a little bypass valve in rear shocks that goes between a positive and negative chamber. So you can, pull out the plunger, fill up the syringe from the top. So you just pour it in from the bottle. It's way easier to load the syringe. And then you can stick the plunger on up to the point where the whole thing is sealed. And then at that point, you can just take the head, you just stick it right on the valve, inject your sealant, however much you need. It's a pretty high capacity. I think it holds like 60 cc's, something like that. So it's a pretty big syringe. But one of the things I really like about it is when you're done, it has a little rubber plug that goes into the end of it.
Yeah, smart.
Which means that you don't have to rinse it out every time to keep it from drying out and clogging.
And that is why I don't use sealant syringes at this time.
Yeah.
So that might actually solve that complaint for me.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that is something that's very clever, very simple, very, you know, I think very almost ingenious. But it's also not very expensive. I think Stan could have charged a lot more for it. It's $15, which seems very, very reasonable to me.
Yeah.
Tubeless, I think, is kind of a pain for a lot of people. So anything that is out there that can make the whole process a little bit easier is a good thing in my book.
You had another tool in your gallery that caught my eye, something from PrestaCycle.
Oh, yeah. So I think they're calling it.
You thought I was going to say Abbey Bike Tools new tools, but I already have those in my garage because they're just they're the Noble Tools IP. So we won't talk about those, but we will talk about the new pump heads.
So PrestaCycle is a little brand that always seems to have quite a lot of little like problem solver tools and little widgets and that sort of thing. But they have a whole bunch of new inflator heads. This one goes on to... this one threads onto a Schrader head. I think you can adapt it to other things, but it's basically just a press-on press-to-chuck. And the idea of a press-on press-to-chuck is not new. But what's cool about this is it's a really low-effort chuck to push on, but then there's a little metal jaw inside that locks it on and seals everything together. And then after you're done pumping up your tire, there's a little red button on the back, and you just push that, and it just sort of effortlessly pops off. So it doesn't, like, shoot off. You don't have to, like, yank it off or anything. You don't really have to worry about, like, having the whole thing let go and, like, your knuckles flying into a brake rotor or sharp spokes or something like that. I don't remember how much this thing is. It's maybe like $20 or $30. It's not very expensive. But so far I've only been using it just a few times today, and it is a neat little thing. I'm pretty happy with it so far.
Yeah, I am keen to try one of those.
So yeah, I'm happy enough with it right now that I'm in the process of adapting it to one of my pumps, to like replacing that old head and using this one instead, because this one just seems to work a lot better. So, nice. Except for a couple little bits, it's all metal construction too, so it feels nice and sturdy. So we'll see how it holds up, but I'm pretty impressed with this one. Pretty good.
Nice. Anything else that you saw and wish you'd had room in your suitcase to yoink?
You know, I don't know about that, but one thing that seemed pretty good. So there's this little San Diego company called 5Dev. I think my understanding is they mostly do machined bits for the aerospace industry.
Isn't it a subdivision of a actual CNC manufacturer?
Something like that. Yeah.
It actually makes the five axis machines.
Something like that. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely like the bicycle division is a tiny, tiny portion of it's basically sort of like a hobby of their employees. Mm. So, yeah, the company's called 5Dev. And they showed off this hollow titanium road gravel crankset. And that looks pretty sweet, actually. I don't know if it's any good. But the way that they make it is pretty neat. Like they basically hollow out this, or they machine and hollow out the back of these titanium arms, and then they weld on a titanium plate on the back to make it hollow and grind that flush. Looks super cool. But what I was actually more excited about from them was this UDH conversion kit that they offer. And right now it's only for some specialized bikes like late model Tarmac, Crux, and Diverge, mainly apparently because that's specialized the bike brand that most of the people at 5Dev ride. None of those bikes have UDH, but this kit that 5Dev has made allows you to put a T-type rear derailleur onto one of those frames. So if you're riding gravel, then you can run mullet setup with that new SRAM transmission rear derailleur. And if SRAM ever does end up introducing T-type on the road, that'll let you put that on there too. Pretty cool.
Very cool. So cool. In fact, we have discussed it on this podcast before.
Oh, we did. That's right.
Yeah. But when we did discuss it, 5Dev were only offering it with a complete
transmission kit. That's right.
So this is new in that you can now just buy the part, which is great to see.
Yeah, and it's like $200, I think, something like that. So
cheaper
they
than
did
a new frame.
Yeah, it's way cheaper than a new frame. I like that it just gives you more options. So they did say that they are certainly more than open to developing other kits for other frames, but it really would depend on whether or not the numbers made sense. I mean, there's an awful lot of Tarmacs and Cruxes and Diverges out there, big, big customer base, and that one kit that they made fits all those bikes. Mm. So again, it's the sort of thing where they don't want to make a kit that only fits a handful of bikes that not very many people have. So it's just a matter of making, finding something that makes sense for them in terms of volume and production, that sort of thing.
And now you can make yourself a Tarmac.
Yeah, yes. Dave.
Sorry.
What else? Couple of other little things. So Expedo is a Taiwanese pedal company. They've got a whole bunch of models, road, mountain, whatever, you name it. And they had a power meter road pedal that they had previewed a couple of years ago that seemingly never came out. And they've kind of changed course on their approach for power meters now, because now what they've done is they previewed a spindle-based setup. And what's interesting about that is it's not dedicated to any one of their particular pedal platforms, because they use modular spindles in a lot of their designs. This new power meter setup that they have coming out with pretty soon, it's called Omni, dual-sided. It works on a whole bunch of their pedals, from like the M-Force to the Baldwin to their SPD SL version or their Thrust. So it goes into at least four or five different pedal models that they make. Total price is like $750 to $900, depending on what the pedal is. Supposedly only adds 50 grams per set, uses regular CR2032 coin cell batteries. There is a small change in Q factor, not big, but it's like 2 to 4 millimeters per side, apparently, depending on which pedal it is. Who knows if these will actually hit the market? It sounds like they're supposed to pretty soon, but again, I can't remember what their claims were for accuracy or anything like that, but good to have more options.
Probably worth noting that Expedo has some experience in this space, and that they were for a long time, and I think they still are, the pedal body manufacturer for Favero.
Correct.
So, and I think Favero's latest MX Pro, the mountain bike pedal, the SPD that I tested, that is Favero's first in-house designed and their own pedal body. So, you know, perhaps with them moving towards their own design, Expedo's decided it's time to fill that gap for themselves. So, yeah, it's interesting timing, but I think they should find some success if the international pricing works out to be as competitive as it looks.
That, and I like how they have designed it as a modular system, mainly because for sure the pedals that seemingly would be most appealing to people for a power meter setup would be road pedals and cross-country pedals. Mm-hmm. Serious enduro riders, they do use power to train, and they're very serious about their training too. So it is kind of neat that you can also put this into something like that Baldwin or one of the heavier duty pedals if you want to have power just all the time, and the fact that it's such a minimal weight penalty. It's pretty appealing. So mm-hmm. Again, good to see more options.
For sure. Speaking of power meters, is now a good time to discuss a brand that wasn't at Sea Otter?
Oh, we certainly could if you want to go into that.
Stages Cycling, we've got a story online about that it appears they've released and let go basically their entire staff, and that no one is at the office to answer responses. But yeah, I assume you didn't see Stages Cycling at Sea Otter?
Stages was most definitely not there.
Yeah, okay. All right. So yeah, it does look like Stages of perhaps coming to a close as the company as we know it. It's definitely a story that keeps... it's a developing story, I guess we should say, because they still have a parent company, and there's now been a lawsuit from Giant, who is a manufacturer for a lot of Stages products, for unpaid invoices. So yeah, certainly a developing story.
Yeah, Ronan has he published a post on this either yesterday or the day before, I can't remember now, kind of just going through how we got to this point, because Stages really was the originator of the low-cost power meter, and it really did seem like they had a huge head start on a lot of people, so it's pretty disappointing, maybe a little surprising that they're in this position. Mm. But COVID really, really did not treat Stages well for a couple of reasons. One was most of their power meters were built onto Shimano crank arms, which as most of the people listening to this podcast maybe already know, or maybe can painfully remember, Shimano parts during COVID were exceptionally difficult to get, particularly for a company like Stages. So that was a problem. And then we also had that microchip shortage, which was kind of a double whammy for Stages. So while lots of bike companies were pulling in a lot of revenue during COVID and selling stuff like crazy, Stages probably wanted to jump onto that bandwagon, wanted to be part of that train, but they couldn't because they couldn't get stuff. So they just didn't have things to sell. So that was a huge problem. And then, there was a big investment. So they're also super big into indoor bikes, particularly like gym quality stuff. Giant was suing them for, I guess is or was suing them for unpaid bills, because as you mentioned, Dave, Giant manufactured a lot of that stuff for Stages. Mm. So that certainly didn't help. More competitors came on, like Four Eyes and stuff, so on and so forth. So, you know, in between the supply issues and then seemingly not really being able to keep up with the segment that they arguably created was a problem. They launched into computers, which really weren't very good. And I'm sure that mm-hmm. cost them a ton of money. So it was a problem. So as of right now, the latest news that we got is that several of the key staff that used to be at Stages now work for Giant. So Giant is building up its own power meter business, and they have been for the last few years. A lot of their high-end road bikes in particular come with power meter stock, their own branded ones. And based on the people that they've brought on, it sounds like that will continue.
Yeah. I will say that it sounds like Stages own some pretty valuable IP, and perhaps they just haven't had the revenue to ever protect that IP from most of the market that apparently infringes on it. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see someone acquire the brand, even if it's just for using the IP and maybe for access to a pretty extensive customer database. But
I mean, at this point, it could still be Giant. I mean, Giant was originally going to plan. They were originally planning to invest like $20 million US in early 2023, and that fell through.
Yeah.
They can probably get stages for a lot cheaper now.
Yeah. Yeah. Either way, one to watch. Speaking of brands that weren't at Ciota, I guess the talk of the town has been Kona bikes. So just a week ago, we were talking about Kona having a brand new model that they launched the day before Ciota. And then I think it was within 6 hours of us recording that podcast, we heard news that they'd pulled down their entire booth and gone home.
Something like that. Yeah. And then we decided to leave that segment in because we still didn't have any info, really.
No.
And we still don't have a lot of info, but it was definitely not encouraging that apparently the entire Kona staff had set up the booth at Sea Otter. And before the show had even kicked off, they apparently had been instructed to take the whole booth down and just disappear. So no official word on what was going on. They didn't have any sort of announcement or anything like that. They still haven't had any official announcement. So we don't know, certainly not officially, if the company is still around, if it's for sale or what's going on.
We know a little bit.
What do we know that we can talk about,
Dave? I mean, it's definitely developing. But yeah, I mean, according to Bicycle Retailer and Industry News, the parent company, which is Kent Outdoors, very different company to the other Kent, which makes low-cost supermarket bikes. But Kent Outdoors, they're sort of snow and water sports specialists. They only acquired Kona in 2022 from the brand's founders. And officially, they're now looking to get out of it. So they've implemented a new CFO to help with selling the brand. And their goal is to find a new home for Kona and hopefully recoup some of their investment. But mismanagement and from what I hear, incompetence has led to this this event of people not understanding the bike industry, buying a bike company and not doing anything great with it.
I mean, my God, how many times have we watched this story play out? Like, it's how many times have we seen someone from outside the bike industry come and buy a bike company expecting it to run the way that they think it's going to run? And then the bike industry, being the kind of odd little duck that it is, doesn't really play along with that. And then they're kind of like, "Wow, this isn't working the way it was supposed to. We're not making very much money. We're out of here."
Yeah. And Darius, it's not a great time to be trying to sell such a bike brand. There's a lot of businesses have too much inventory and not a whole lot of cash flow at the moment. And yeah, so I think it'll be interesting to see where this ends up. Kona is a pretty legendary brand. You think there's some pretty valuable, assets to be had there as far as a brand that you can slap onto some frames and actually sell. So I would love to see them continue. The big question is in what capacity will we see them continue?
In what capacity? And, you know, obviously it's a big question whether they'll ever regain their former glory. Mm-hmm. At this point, it just seems like they've taken such a hit in terms of prestige and reputation and stuff like that. Like that when they were running that kind of that buy one, get one sale for a while. Yeah. And it wasn't even just like buy one nice bike, get a cheap bike free. It was like buy one nice bike, get another nice bike for free.
A second one. Yeah.
Stuff like that just doesn't do well as far as a brand's reputation. Like that does a lot of long-term damage.
Absolutely. So in thinking around about this, my first guess, and I'll explain why this could be and also why it probably won't be, but I wouldn't be surprised if I saw Pond pick it up. So Pond being the massive conglomerate that already owns Santa Cruz, Cervelo, Cannondale, GT, Mongoose. They just bought 1UP Components recently, which has surprised me. They're in Reserve Wheels, obviously. They have Focus. They have Gazelle, Urban Arrow. The list is insane. And what's one more brand when your list is that big?
I guess. I mean, we have no idea what Kent is looking to get out of Kona.
Yeah. Not what they paid. I think that is evidence.
Sure, sure. Yeah, would it make sense for Pond? I mean, I guess, so, it would really depend on how much Pond got, or how much Pond was able to get Kona for.
So my reasoning, the way I say this is, Kona is actually a pretty cool brand in sort of that like adventure style gravel bikepacking kind of quirky commuter space. And Pond doesn't actually have anything in that space at the moment. There's also kind of a segment of mountain bike there that Kona plays in that none of the Pond brands are really particularly great at, in terms of like cool sort of free ride heritage at a value price point. But then I guess GT and Mongoose kind of overlap in that regard. So it makes sense and it also doesn't make sense. But yeah, as far as businesses big enough to actually make such an acquisition, Pond has surely got to be high on the list.
Hmm. Intriguing.
Anyway, I would like to see this brand continue. I still have very fond memories of Kona as I was coming into the sport. And yeah, fingers crossed.
I agree. Well, one brand, kind of just circling back to the Sea Otter thing just for a moment. One brand that was sort of there in kind of like a stealthy style that does look like it has a much brighter future. So Ronan wrote pretty recently about that funky high bar single strap helmet thing, which was seemingly super weird. So they were there. I can't talk about what helmet they showed it on, as far as what brands are going to be using it. But I was able to try the helmet on. I didn't ride in it, but so like Ronan, I was able to try it on, like really, really check it out. It was way less goofy than I expected it to be, both in terms of fit and feel and visually. Like, it definitely was a little weird having this sort of kind of flexible, rubbery plastic thing against your skin instead of this nylon strap.
Yeah.
But it was very easy and straightforward to use. It actually was pretty decently comfortable, particularly given how the tops of the anchors of the straps are sort of like set off from the surface of your skin. Honestly, the thing that I was kind of most excited about, so, you know, they're talking about how it takes a lot of the guesswork out of putting helmets on and properly putting them on, which for anybody out there with kids, I think they can attest that kids very, very rarely have their helmets on tight or properly at all.
The adjustment of the Y splitter.
There are a lot of safety and kind of like a lot of variability questions that this thing potentially answers. But one thing that I was really excited about was their claims about wind noise. I've always found wind noise and aerodynamic efficiency and helmets to be seemingly pretty well correlated. They are saying that there's a pretty big aero gain for this thing. Like, they're actually saying it was like 7 watts, which is huge.
Whoa.
Could be potentially massive if it really is anything like that. And they're saying that's even compared to a set of nylon straps that are fitted pretty well and trimmed pretty well and everything. Anyway, I'm really pretty intrigued with their claims of significantly reduced wind noise, because wind noise is just, it just bugs me. And I've always wondered what the long-term ramifications are for that sort of persistent low-level white noise for hours and hours on end in terms of hearing damage.
Sorry, what was that last point?
Dave, God, again. Anyway, I'm curious. So these helmets are apparently coming out really not too far. I think we're going to see them officially launched this season.
Under what? Was it Canyon that has first access, or is that unconfirmed?
I think those were the sneak peeks that we had seen. So again, I can neither confirm nor deny that right now, Dave.
Okay. All right.
It does sound like we're going to see them officially this season, but I was pretty impressed with what I saw. I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, it's cool. It's a cool step forward in helmet progression.
So pretty interesting. So, I mean, nylon straps have been around for a long time, and just because that's how things have always been doesn't necessarily mean that that's how they always should be. So we will find out.
Nice.
All right, Dave, I know that this is a podcast and our audience can't see our faces and everything, but I'm sitting here staring at your face on my computer screen, and I can just tell that something's kind of weighing on you. Do you need to talk? What's on your mind this week, Dave?
My shoulders are loaded with the conversation of Chainloop.
Is it ever not?
I mean, and there's also tools and I mean, that's about it really. Chain lube. I have always, like many people, lubed a chain at the bottom rung of the chain. So sort of between the derailleur pulley and the bottom of the chain ring, and backpedaled drip chain lube into place there. And I've always done that for a few reasons, but I've always felt that it sort of assists with the lube going where you want it and not all over the cassette. And it also is further away from the disc brake rotor, so you're less likely to splash onto the disc brake rotor. However,
I've always done it the opposite way.
Yeah. So Ceramic Speed a little while ago pointed out that they recommend lubing a chain closer to the top of the cassette, just before just forward of the cassette. And Josh Portner of Silka has now followed suit and has released a video explaining why. And basically, if you were to put the chain in your largest sprocket at the back or the one down from there, and ideally the big chain ring, but a lot of bikes are just going to be one by, so that's not a choice. But
either way, cross chain essentially.
You're basically opening up a gap within the chain rollers and the plates that allows lube to get into the roller where you want it. And what Josh had showed on the video is that it actually creates kind of like a, as the roller moves to the cog from that angle, it actually kind of like pumps air into it. It kind of creates like this pumping action. And he was able to articulate a chain on top of a drop of lube sitting on a table. And by articulating the chain, it actually wicked the chain lube up off the table into the chain, and he showed it with a microscope.
What sort of black magic are we talking about here, Dave?
So the idea is if you're lubing the chain while it's cross-chained just before the cassette, it's backpedaling.
Okay.
You're opening up a gap for the lube to flow into the chain, and two, it kind of creates this like pumping action between the angled rollers that kind of pulls the lube in. I'm impressed, and it makes a hell of a lot of sense for like wax based lubes that can have link penetration issues as far as getting the lube into the chain, which is something that Silka's lube tried to fix by making it more watery, thinner viscosity, and in turn it tends to get more drips. So this is another way to solve for those drips.
Intriguing.
So yeah, there you go. I learned something, and I suspect others will have too. I will say, take care, because you're now very close to the disc brake rotor. So that would be one reason to go one cog down from your biggest cog, is just to give it that little bit of a barrier to stop any potential spray.
It maybe is also worth mentioning that as you are backpedaling and applying lube, you don't really need to like super energetically backpedal.
Yeah.
You sort of just kind of like gently backpedal.
It's a slow thing. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you don't need to go at like, you know, 90, 100 RPM or anything like that.
Yeah. And then another thing with chain lube is you often see brands recommend a drop per link. Don't waste your life doing that. just smoothly backpedal and let the lube flow.
Perfect. So that's what I've always done anyway.
It's more wasteful.
Excellent.
It's more wasteful, but then that way you're not doing 116 drops. It's just, yeah. A little bit of excess isn't going to hurt you.
Maybe you're doing like 130 drops or something.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, that's, I wouldn't stress about dropping a drip into each individual link, because, yeah, there's better things in life.
Well, and again, it seems like one of those things where we've talked at length about the, not just the friction, but certainly the drivetrain longevity benefits of using a wax-based chain lube. And again, like, it's not for everyone necessarily, but a lot of people are resistant to using wax-based chain lube because they feel like there's like a super dedicated and involved process to it. And like, there is to some extent, at least initially.
Yep.
But I feel like if the actual process of relubing your chain, particularly with some of the newer drip-based wax lubes, don't have to be super involved and don't have to be super complicated, then again, like if it's easier for people to do it, then that's a good thing.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, this really does apply to all drip chain lubes. So yeah, go forth. Enjoy.
Cool. All right. Well, Dave, this is actually one of the first shows that we've had in a while that wasn't just like totally, totally bogged down in news. So we've got time for like a PSA and a pick one.
It feels pretty news heavy so far. And we've still got some more news to cover.
Very little, though. Not a whole lot.
That's true. All right, let's do it.
All right, let's jump into our PSA here. Our managing editor, Matt Deneef, he recently shared with the rest of the staff on Slack that he'd finally chased down this kind of mysterious creak on his bike.
Turns out it was his knee.
Unfortunately, turns out it was his brain. It was unfortunately a pretty decent little crack around one of the spoke holes on his aluminum rear wheel. Dave, you decided that we should kind of turn this PSA into a quick little general bit on sort of just how to track down creaks and weird noises on your bike in general. What do you want to talk about here?
Yeah, I think this is definitely a huge topic that we could have a dedicated podcast to, and perhaps maybe we should at some point. But yeah, I think chasing noises is one of those things that can drive people crazy and can be very hard for some people to find. But I think there are some techniques that bike mechanics use to sort of narrow down on where the noise is coming from, and you'd be surprised at how rarely it's the bottom bracket, because everyone seems to assume it's the bottom bracket.
It is always the bottom bracket, Dave, always.
So yeah, so I mean the first thing is like figuring out while you're riding, try to figure out what's causing the noise. Like, does it happen when you're standing? Does it happen when you're sitting down? Does it happen under high power, under low power? What is the noise as well? Like, is it a squeak? Is it a tick? Is it an actual like kind of movement-based groan that you'd get from like a splintered IKEA furniture?
What if it's more like your bike is screaming?
Take the possum out of it. But but yeah, so I think there's a few things, like really figuring out what the noise is and then under what situations it happens. Like, does it happen in every single gear or in only one gear? Does it happen when you're braking? Does it happen if you're not braking?
Pushing down with your left foot versus your right?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, figuring that out and understanding the conditions where it's happening will greatly help you in figuring out what component it may or may not be. And it'll especially help if you were to take your bike into a mechanic, asking them to find a creak. So rather than paying for them to rebuild your entire bike, they might actually be able to find it much more quickly if you have that sort of information.
Right. That, and it's also kind of important to kind of understand the nuances of the terminology between like a creak and a tick versus like a squeak or that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Because all of those things really do mean different things to your mechanic.
Yeah. So like a creek is less than a river that tends to be a body of water.
And okay. Where's my mute button?
Sorry. A creek is basically caused by movement between two parts that shouldn't be moving. This is where audio is actually very useful. If we actually had said audio to play what a creek sounds like. A tick is sort of more, how would you say it? It's more a regular frequency noise, something like that you'd get once every pedal revolution.
So a creak, I would say, the way I've always described a creak is a creak is essentially when you have two parts that are under load that essentially just sort of slip very slightly against each other. It oftentimes requires a little bit more pedaling force or just a little bit more force on the bike in general. Not always, but oftentimes it does. And then it's oftentimes kind of loud because like those parts need to be loaded and then they let go.
Yeah.
Like if I wanted to think of it in sort of like geography terms or geological terms or something like that, I guess it's almost sort of like tectonic plates that are just loading and then just let go. It's almost like that creak is sort of like your little mini earthquake.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, with us having not pre-recorded sounds, I think probably not a lot of point us trying to explain what a sound sounds like. But I will say, yeah, whatever noise you're getting, once you figure out what circumstances are causing it, if you've got another bike that you can take parts off of, or if you've got spare parts, then this at this point I'd start to do some process of elimination stuff. So say you have a spare rear wheel, put that in, see if that fixes the noise. Start by, you know, tightening your skewers or through axle, see if that fixes it. If you've got a different set of pedals, try a different set of pedals. If you've got a different pair of shoes, try that, because it could be your cleats. And just go through that process of elimination and hopefully you find it.
Dave, let me ask you this. What is the most obscure source of an annoying noise that you can recall?
My, I've had it more than once as well, is an out of the saddle creak that turned out to be the seat post, between the seat post and seat tube, and that the frame was flexing enough against the seat post to creak. And when you were in the saddle, you were creating enough load that it stopped that movement. Like you were basically like loading up the seat post to then sit firmly against the frame. Out of the saddle, the frame would have enough movement to creak against the seat post.
Interesting. I think mine is somewhat similar, except that it was also a metal frame. It also was something that only occurred when you were loading the frame pretty hard. But this turned out to be the frame itself. And apparently it was sourced down to a bad miter at the bottom bracket.
I've been there, unfortunately, with a personal bike as well.
Oof.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway.
And that, right, well, that is somewhere, and I'm just, this is kind of a funny story, but that is one time where having a column related specifically to best practice maintenance actually helped me, because I was dealing with the warranty guy and he was like, no, try this. And then the brand manager stepped in and he's like, I think if Dave's saying he can't find the creek, I think we should just replace the frame. yeah, anyway, new frame did fix it immediately.
Nice. All right. How about that?
Yeah.
All right. Well, that, I guess, was that really a PSA, or was that kind of just more like a random tech tip sort of thing?
Probably a random tech tip. Yeah. I've wanted to do it for ages, but I really want to get sound bites of each sort of individual noise and make something of it.
Oh, this seems like something that we should do when we have a full panel of mechanics on hand.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe video.
Speaking of which, we are long, long, long overdue for an Ask a Wrench episode. And I know we've been talking about it for a while, but
yes.
Dave, we got to make that happen.
Maybe next week.
Yes, for sure.
Okay.
All right. We still have some time. Dave, should we do our pick one? I think you actually picked the category this week.
Well, you spoke about pump heads before with that new presser cycle. And I would like to discuss floor pumps as a category.
Okay.
Mainly because I think you and I are pretty well aligned on this, but it's one category that I get asked a lot about for doing a comparison test on, because I've done comparison tool tests in the past and floor pump seems like a logical one to do. And I've been shy to do it because what most people don't understand is that there's really only two major pump manufacturers in this world, and they produce I'm gonna make up a number here, but I'm gonna say 95% of floor pumps in the market.
So one of them is, what is it, Geo? Is that one of them?
Geo and Beto is the other one.
Oh, that's right, Beto. Yep.
And because of that, there are differences between brands of floor pumps, but you also get hundreds of like these micro brands that are basically selling the exact same thing with a different name on it. And so for me to do a comparison test of tools, I really like being able to say like definitively, this is the best. And when there's hundreds of same pumps, I just don't want to have to like explain individually that, yes, your pump that you love so much is actually the same as these 20 others. So that is exactly why I haven't done such a test to date. Also, I still have, what do you call it?
Do you have a little PTSD from your last?
Yeah, exactly. From when I did a test of 43 hand pumps. So anyway.
There were still some you missed, by the way, Dave. All right. Well, Dave, you suggested this pick one category. Yeah. And now you just went into this little diatribe about how they're all, yeah, how all the pumps are the same.
Yeah. So with that said, my absolute favorite that I, so, okay, let me rewind slightly. I actually don't use floor pumps very often anymore.
okay. All right. So you came up with this idea for this pick one, yeah, category.
Yeah.
And first, and then, you start talking then, about how all the pumps are the same.
Yeah.
And then second, you talk about how you actually don't use floor pumps anymore anyway. What, yeah, what is the point of this pick one category, Dave?
There isn't one. I mean, I'm going to get to it. But so my, what I use instead of floor pumps almost all the time now is just the little Fumpa, which is the little electronic pump, which is really quick. It doesn't have any, yeah, it's got a very short distance between the hose and the pump. So when you connect it to the, when you connect it to a tire, it loses almost no air. So then you're not having to pump up what you just lost. And for me, if I'm riding a bike, say once a week, and it loses a few PSI, I literally just have to hold a button for 3 or 4 seconds before it gets me back to my pressure, and it tells me my pressure on the pump, and job done. The negative to it is noise. And
it's so loud.
So if I need to sneak out for a ride early in the morning and someone's sleeping, then I do use a floor pump. And at that point, the floor pump I like to use is the Silka Digital. I don't know the full name of it.
Oh, actually, I do, because I have that on my list too. It's the Super Pista Digital.
Yes, and insanely expensive. I did buy mine. I cried a little at the time. I've had it for 4 or 5 years now. It is still
perfect.
It's
a very good pump, though.
Yeah, it is incredibly good pump. Dare I say, it's not Silka's most expensive. Dare I say, it's their best.
I would agree with you there, because I actually like that one more than the Pista Ultimate that they, mm-hmm, that they also offer. So this one is not quite as expensive, mainly because it's not made in the US like that Ultimate model that they have. But I actually really, really like that top mounted digital gauge. I like that it reads in, you know, fractions of, or like, you know, it goes to one more, it goes in tenths of a PSI.
Yeah.
It seems to be quite well made. It's really easy to rebuild. You can get parts for it. And it actually has a pretty good balance of pressure and volume. So I use it for mountain bikes and road bikes. And
yeah,
especially now that I don't pump up my road bike tires all that high anyway, works pretty well for both.
My favorite feature with it is the pump gauge turns itself on when it senses pressure.
It does. It does. Yeah,
which,
that is correct.
Infuriates me with most other digital pumps.
I do wish that I have found that the battery life in the gauge is not very good, and also uses, I think it's like a stack of three CR2032s. Yeah, the battery life could be a little bit better, so that's a little bit of a bummer. But overall, I have pretty few complaints for it.
Yeah.
I would say that is generally my go-to, especially if I'm trying to have consistent and repeatable tire pressures for testing purposes, that sort of thing. What I use more often in the in my workshop, just for kind of general purpose use, though, is I don't even know if they still make this, but Topeak has a pump called the Joblo Ace. It's a dual chamber pump, and it's like a three stage design. You can flick it between low pressure, high volume, or kind of like a medium setting, or high pressure, low volume. And the reason why I like it is because the low volume setting puts out an awful lot of air. And yeah, I have used like booster chambers or booster canisters and floor pumps that have built-in boosters, that sort of thing, helping to seat tubeless tires. But this thing puts out so much air that I have found that I have very, very, very rarely have needed it. And I don't even know how many years I've had this thing now, and it's just been going strong.
Yeah. Yeah. So obviously, like, that Silka pump is big money, and I have a hard time recommending it based on that. You know, it's only a small percentage of the market that could ever afford that pump. But for everyone else, I'd say Topeak and Lazine, which I'll get to in a sec, are the two brands to really consider and really look at, simply because, as you say, James, you can repair them and you can get access to spare parts. Most pumps on the market you can actually repair, but getting said seals and little bits is hard. But Topeak and Lazine actually have really strong global distribution of such parts, and that's a reason to go with those brands. So Topeak, super reliable choice. very hard to fault their pumps. Their pump heads are great. The pumps just work. And even from like the most basic all the way through to the most expensive, sort of the Ace that you mentioned there, they're a very good pick. For me, I actually really love the Lazine Aluminium, the CNC range, which is like quite luxurious. Hate their pump heads with a passion. So a Lazine CNC with a changed pump head. I really like pump heads from Arundel at the moment because they're a very good price. And they're kind of like, they do one which is kind of similar to Silka's Hero pump head, but works more consistently and is just a simpler version of it. Yeah, so for me, like the Lazine CNC with a cheap Arundel pump head is kind of up there in terms of earning my appreciation of the Silka Digital.
Hmm. That's funny that you mentioned that Silka, that Lazine pump, because it's funny, not too long ago, I can't remember why, I needed a spare pump for something and I didn't want to go out and spend a lot of money on a spare pump. So I started looking on Craigslist, I think it was Craigslist, and I found someone who was selling, it was just a few blocks away actually, selling a whole bunch of used floor pumps. And one specifically was a Lazine pump that they said didn't work. And I'm like, I bet I can fix that. So I went over there. I think I bought it for like $5, $10, maybe something like that. And of course, I fixed it for next to nothing. And that's my spare pump now. Worked great.
Nice. While I'm giving props to Lazine, let me just take it away because they make a tire booster pump, a tubeless
floor pump. Oh, it's terrible.
Do not get that. That is...
It's awful.
That is just...
not my favorite.
No. So, they're regular pumps. I can speak highly of if you get a different valve head, pump head for them. But yeah, their tire booster is goddamn awful.
So I will say, if Topeak ever made a version of that Joe Blow Ace with a digital gauge, I would say that at that point, that would probably just be my one pump. I wouldn't need another one. That would be it. Yeah.
All right. So if we're picking one, I guess we're landing on Topeak because they come with a pump head that is actually good to use and you can rebuild them and they work.
I think so. Although right now, if I had to still pick between my Silka Digital and that Topeak, I think I'd probably still go with the Digital just because I really have learned to rely on that gauge.
Yeah. Yeah, same. Okay. All right. So we're picking the same one then.
I would go with that.
The expensive one. We're picking the expensive one.
Okay. All right. With that out of the way, now that you actually have picked a floor pump, Dave, do we have any little bits of news to share before we sign off for the day?
We do. There's a couple of remaining things. Time, they got acquired by SRAM. SRAM had then moved the manufacturing facilities from France to its chain manufacturing facility in Portugal. So they're now manufactured in-house. They have revamped the lineup. So they get an aesthetic change. So they're now all new graphics across the range, some nice pretty colors in the mountain bikes. There's some new mountain bike pedals to look at. But yeah, I guess in the road, they've simplified that range. So the high-end road...
Which is good, because there were way too many before.
In the high-end road, it's now the X Pro is the model to look at. And there's 12 versions. There's three versions of that. There's the X-Pro 12 SL, which is a titanium spindle pedal running on ceramic bearings. There's the X-Pro 12, and then the X-Pro 10, which is a steel spindle pedal. And what's new about those is they've added three spindle width options into the mix. So, I suspect that pedal will now become quite attractive to bike fitters and the like for the options.
Well, because that was one of the things that really kept people on Speedplay for a long time was just because Speedplay offered different spindle lengths. Whereas really, I mean, I think if I remember correctly, Shimano offered like a longer version in one pedal version or one pedal model, something like that. Mm-hmm. But that was kind of about it. So now with Time introducing three spindle widths or spindle lengths, I guess we should say. So they have the regular and then the narrow and the wide. I can't remember what the actual difference is in stance width. But with them offering that, I mean, I would have to think, particularly with so much of the turmoil that's been going on with Speedplay in the last couple of years, I would have to imagine that a lot of fitters are going to be moving over to Time.
Yeah, yeah. And it's also now one of the lighter systems as well as you get into the higher price points. They've also added, so those X-Pro pedals run with kind of like a carbon spring. And they've also added some tension adjustment to that, which is quite cool. So yeah, there are some nice little changes. Overall, it looks much like the same old pedals, still same cleat system. But yeah, I think the changes they've added there look pretty positive. And then for the more budget-oriented stuff, there's the Espresso range. So there's just two in that range, which, again, looks like a pretty good entry-level pedal.
In terms really, of weight to cost?
Yeah.
Weight to cost, the Espresso is hands down like the best out there.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, I think SRAM's doing, you know, just enough of what's required to bring that brand up to the promise that it once had. So
nice, nice.
And then otherwise, on the news front, there was a little appearance of what looks to be new SRAM Red at Tuatarumati. I guess what it does confirm is that, yeah, it looks like the new shifter works with the old derailleurs. So suspecting that we're going to see a lot of cross-compatibility there. But that's probably all I can say at this time.
Hmm. All right, then. Fair enough.
And then lastly on the list, we've got a recall. A big one.
Wah, wah.
Yeah. FSA's Gossamer Pro AGX crank. It was equipped on a lot of bikes. There's about 12,000 of them in the market.
AGX, that's a gravel crank from them, right?
It is. And yeah, they've had to have a recall of it. So
did they say why?
Falling off.
Hmm. That's a good reason.
Yeah. I think there's actually more than 12,000 because it's 12,300 in the US and Canada. So yeah, and it only impacts so yeah, it's sold on bikes from starting from 2022 through to mid 2023. And you can check yours if you have one of these, the AGX Plus crankset. The recall only impacts those with serial numbers beginning in B1, B2, or B3. But yeah, do check that your crank is not about to fall off. Because that is bad, as anyone with a Shimano Ultegra or Durace crank probably is aware
and
of.
And I was going to say, this process does not involve a lengthy dealer inspection, video process thing, whatever, or like they're just replacing them.
They're just replacing them, unlike Shimano, which were doing an inspection, and now it's, as we knew it would happen, it's now coming to light that cranks
still
that were
breaking.
Inspected 4 or 5 months ago are now breaking. So, yeah, I don't think Shimano's quite done enough with the millions of cranks out there, but good to see FSA taking the correct steps here to get these off the market.
All right. Well, I guess we'll wrap up on that. All right. Well, I guess that'll do it for this week's episode of Geek Warning. Thanks, as always, for listening, and an extra special thank you if you're one of our Escape Collective members, because If you're sitting there right now thinking to yourself that, you know, kind of how pleasant the listening experience has been, then that's because we haven't had any ads.
Oh, right. Sorry.
That's because we didn't have any ads to interrupt that nice flow.
Oh, right.
Okay. And that's because we are a 100% member-funded operation. So our members do get full access to the complete selection of written and audio content. And you also kind of get the satisfaction of knowing that you support a media publication that actually works for you, instead of advertisers or affiliate partners, because I don't know about you, but when I see those affiliate links everywhere, that just feels kind of icky. Anyway, if you are not a member, head over to escapecollective.com/join. You can choose between two tiers of membership as well as monthly or annual payment options. I think we actually still offer lifetime too, if you wanted to do that. Fill in a few bits of info and you're good to go. For the rest of you responsible folks out there, thanks as always for listening. And we'll see you next week for another episode of Geek Warning.
Thank you. Cheers.